Hi, I'm Brian Pearson. This is The Mystic Cave.
We were born before the wind. Also younger than the sun. And our bonnet boat was one as we sailed into the Mystic. Hark now, hear the sailors.
The Mystic Cave is a sanctuary for the seeker. Stories, conversations, and reflections about the spiritual journey on the other side of Churchland. Through the summer months, I'm offering something a little lighter than our usual fare. This is because I need to take a break from producing a weekly program, and because you might enjoy some summertime storytelling to take with you onto the back deck or out on a road trip. Each week, I'll be reading from How the Light Gets In, a collection of my short stories published by the Anglican Book Center back in 1999. Despite my urge to do some major rewriting, I've tried to leave these stories pretty much as they were, except where I couldn't help myself. I'll release two stories a week, one on Sunday and one on Thursday. If you don't want to miss a story, be sure to subscribe on whatever format you use for your podcasts. And while you're at it, give the podcast a rating. That helps spread the word. I hope you enjoy these homespun tales as we all take our summer sun. Forgiveness. The kids have all been sent to their rooms. Little feet have stomped on floorboards, toys have been thrown about, doors slammed. My wife is now pacing the hallway, breathing fire and reading the riot act through the walls. I'm being smart, having risen indignant in the midst of the fray to give everyone my sternest and fiercest look. I have now retreated to my study. I'm staying out of the way. If this is the usual scenario, we will have a breakthrough in about 7 minutes. Somewhere a door will creak open and a teary, tremulous voice will call out, "Sorry." My wife will kneel on the floor and hug each one, or perhaps all of them together, and begin negotiating the terms of restitution. And that, hopefully, will be that, at least for now. Forgiveness ought to be a way of life. It isn't, of course. It is rather a way back to life when we've lost our way. And it is never easy, especially among kin. But the alternative is unthinkable. It would be a form of dying. Daniel and Donnie Lucas grew up on a sprawling dairy farm not far from St. Jude's, my first parish. The farm had been in the family for 5 generations. It was understood that one day it would go to Daniel, the oldest. So when the opportunity presented itself, old Mr. Lucas purchased the 100 acres that bordered him on the north. This would be for Donnie, the younger of the two brothers, when he was ready for it. In the meantime, it could be leased out. The northern 100 was separated from the Lucas farm by a small woodlot. The boys grew up playing in that woodlot. In the summer, after chores were done, the long, hot afternoon sun would drive them into the cool shade of the elms and birches. There they made forts from which they lobbed dry mud balls at unsuspecting cows that strayed their way. There, lying on their backs on the cool earth, sharing their daydreams about hockey and cars and, eventually, girls, they measured the slow movement of the sun across the sky and the slow turning of the seasons that led to manhood. Donnie worshipped his older brother and followed him everywhere. In the schoolyard, he was Daniel's constant shadow, moving within Daniel's protective sphere, beyond the reproach of teachers and the abuse of playground bullies. Daniel just had that way about him, a quiet, self-contained confidence and a wisdom beyond his years that earned him the instinctive respect of everyone children, and grown-ups alike. Moving out of the old family farmhouse was not easy for Donnie when the time came, though this was not something he knew how to talk about. When he married Eileen, a perky girl from the neighboring county, they built a house and barn up at the top end of his new property, just off the second concession. The house was a trim white bungalow placed squarely in the middle of a treeless yard. Eileen planted flower gardens on three sides of the house and graced the windows with lace curtains, but years later the house still appeared new and, with the addition of an above-ground pool in the backyard, oddly suburban. By way of contrast, across the driveway stood Donnie's barn, which, after only a few years, looked like it had been there for generations. Its concrete foundation was splattered with red mud. The paint hung in long peeled strips off the auxiliary shed. Bits of machinery littered the dirt compound. Donnie had never been one for keeping up appearances. He and Daniel cleared a rough road through the woodlot, allowing the brothers passage back and forth for the borrowing of farm equipment, and also for Donnie to have a shortcut when he went into town. At first it seemed to Donnie that he'd hardly left home at all. In those early days, when Eileen was working in town, he would arrive for the noonday meal as always, served up on heaping platters by Mrs. Lucas. The conversation between the men would be sparse, old Mr. Lucas presiding over its quiet ebb and flow, beneath Mrs. Lucas's caustic commentary on all the fresh gossip from in and around the community. It would never have occurred to Donnie to do otherwise, to go home for lunch, and why would it have? But after the birth of Sean, their first child, Eileen quit her job to be a full-time mom and farm wife, and she quickly grew resentful of the magnetic pull of Donnie's family. Over time, Donnie's daily visits slowed to a trickle, until eventually, to Eileen's satisfaction, they nearly stopped altogether, except for family occasions like Thanksgiving and Christmas. Donnie found himself drawn more and more from his own familiar surroundings into Eileen's world, a world of children and in-laws and of acquaintances that were not his own. Meanwhile, driving every day through the woodlot on his way to town or to borrow the backhoe, Donnie observed his brother's world growing and flourishing a hundredfold, pressed down, running over. First, their father bought the 95 acres across the road when the McClintocks had to sell. After his father's stroke, Daniel turned it into soybeans, one of the first in the county to do so, and the first actually to turn a profit at it. A few years later, he encouraged his father to apply for a research grant that permitted them to participate in nationwide experiments with artificial insemination. The farm thrived, and his reputation grew. When Mr. Lucas died, the whole operation fell squarely onto Daniel's shoulders, including the care of his mother, whom most people regarded as difficult. Daniel was just about the only one who could reason with her, though he usually preferred simply to let her talk herself through the emotional spectrum from outrage to annoyance to silence to conciliation and eventually to the point where she could laugh at the whole damn thing. As a consequence, he was the only one she would ever listen to, her oldest boy who had grown up so big and smart and filled with that quiet determination she had so loved in his father. When Daniel met and married Margaret a few years later, as the custom was and still is in most farming communities, she moved into his home and came under the watchful eye of her new mother-in-law, in whose opinion Margaret was one of those modern girls who had never learned a thing right and who had to be taught everything all over again. Margaret would work away in the kitchen with her mother-in-law sitting in the old pressed-back rocker, not saying much, but saying too much for the likes of Margaret. Things like, "Myself, I never would try to make pastry on a day so humid as this, but I guess that's the way things are being done now." "I guess so, Mom," Margaret would answer, and she would drop the rolling pin down on the dough with a whack. Over time, Mrs. Lucas's health began to fail, as she reminded her daughter-in-law almost daily, and eventually they moved her bedroom down to where the dining room used to be, beside the kitchen. The idea was that as Mrs. Lucas became more bedridden, Margaret would be close at hand if she needed help with anything, which he did about every 5 minutes or so, it seemed to Margaret, who, by this time, had three preschool children to contend with as well. It was not long before this all proved too much for Margaret. Daniel pleaded quietly with his mother to back off a bit and give his wife some space, let her do things her own way. Finally, Margaret confronted her husband. It would be either her or his mother, she said, but one of them would have to go, and she hoped he didn't really have to think about it. They resolved to move Mrs. Lucas into the nursing home in town, where she could receive the proper care and attention she needed. They didn't tell her or anyone else about it until all the arrangements were made, and then they moved her fast, within a week. When Donnie heard of it, a fury rose within him he had not thought himself capable of. How could his mother be evicted from her own home and by her own son? How could Daniel do this without even consulting him? She was his mother too, for heaven's sake. It was unforgivable, and he and Eileen were not going to stand for it. So, one Saturday morning, they drove into town, picked up his mother, and took her back to their own home, where she lived, hurt and indignant, until she died 3 years later. The two brothers never spoke again. Not for 13 years. Donnie stopped coming over to borrow equipment or pass through to town, and gradually the road through the woodlot grew over. The two children of Donnie and Eileen, and the three of Daniel and Margaret, were forbidden from playing with their cousins, and they grew up hardly knowing one another. Daniel, who had been having a difficult time anyway adjusting to the new rector at St. Jude's, decided it was time to leave the Anglican Church, and he went into town to join the Presbyterians. And that's about where things stood by the time I arrived at St. Jude's. Mrs. Lucas had died years ago. Donnie and Eileen came to church from time to time, but could hardly be described as regulars. I married Sean, their oldest, the first year I was there, but I didn't even know Donnie had a brother until the provincial plowing match the following summer, the year it was held on the old Lucas farm. I met Daniel on his own turf, with pickups and tractor trailers parked the full length of his quarter-mile driveway, John Deere's and Internationals strewn about the west tract, a big hospitality tent set up in his front lawn, and hundreds of farmers in jeans and work boots sipping coffee and trading stories beneath the drone of the loudspeakers. I was new and young, and I wore my clerical collar just about everywhere in those days. I approached Daniel and introduced myself to him. He stood his ground solidly, his feet slightly apart, as he extended his hand. He was a big man, and my hand felt small in his powerful grasp. He was congenial enough, but he watched me, weighing my words while not giving away anything himself. It made me talk too much. I told him I hadn't realized he was Donnie's brother. He just looked at me. I said I was still getting to know the community and how everyone was connected. His face didn't change. So I was sorry, I said, but I must have missed him at Sean's wedding. All friendliness drained from his face. His eyes bore into me. I wasn't at the wedding, he said. I stammered something vaguely apologetic and then, under the force of that gaze, found a reason to excuse myself. It was a piece of overheard gossip that finally brought the brothers together again. At the Monday meeting of the Happy Hookers Craft Guild at the church, Margaret heard a few of the ladies talking in hushed tones out in the kitchen. From the work circle in the other room, she could hear them saying what a shame it was with Donnie being so sick now and in hospital. The next morning, Margaret looked up from the dishes to see Daniel coming down the stairs in his sports jacket, which he never wore, not even to church, his plaid shirt buttoned up to the neck. He looked at her, and their eyes met. Margaret didn't have to ask him where he was going. "Oh, Dan," she said, and she began to cry. He held her, looking out across the yard, fighting back his own emotion. I was at the hospital that day, sitting by Donnie as he struggled to breathe. He had had a cough that fall that wouldn't go away, and he found himself getting increasingly short of breath. He put it down to the wet weather and to his having put on a few pounds over the last few years. But when suddenly, without trying to, he started losing the weight, but not the cough, Eileen grew worried enough to take him to see the doctor. The cancer was all through him by then. Within a week, he was hospitalized with 2, maybe 3 months to live. Daniel didn't see me at first as he entered the room, his cap in his hand. He walked around the other side of the bed. He squinted through his thick eyebrows, trying to recognize this familiar stranger. Donnie lay sleeping, propped up on pillows, his face gaunt and gray, an oxygen mask strapped over his mouth and nose. Daniel glanced over, saw me, but said nothing. For a few moments, there was only the hiss of the oxygen and Donnie's short, shallow gasps. Daniel cleared his throat. He pulled a chair up to the bed and sat down at the edge of it. His lip quivered and his eyes began to fill with tears. His mouth moved, but no sound came. At that moment, Donnie woke up. Struggling to focus, he looked up into the face of his brother. He was too weak to speak, but he raised his hand ever so slightly. Daniel took Donnie's hand in his, and the two men began to sob. Donnie died a mere 6 weeks later. At the funeral, the two families came together for the first time since Mrs. Lucas's death so many years ago. The cousins chatted easily with each other at the reception back in the church hall, and as the small crowd thinned, the older ones drifted together over to the Legion Hall for a beer. The next spring, Daniel recut the road through the woodlot, opening the passage between the two farms. Margaret and Eileen began visiting back and forth. They discovered they shared much in common, including a cache of stories about old Mrs. Lucas. In the lighter moments, they would laugh together until their sides ached. As I write this, sitting in the safety of my study, all is quiet upstairs. My wife is down in the kitchen, waiting, while wounds are licked, emotions soothed, consequences weighed. I think I can hear a door about to open. If I'm right, after we've lost our way, it's the only door we've been given.
And when that foghorn blows, I will be coming home. And when that foghorn blows, I want to hear it. I don't want to fear it. And I want to rock your gypsy soul.
I've been reading from my book, How the Light Gets In, a collection of short stories. I'll be rolling out 2 stories a week in the Mystic Cave through the summer months, and then returning to an interview format come the fall, when we'll be turning our attention to views of death and dying on the other side of Churchland. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch, you can write to me personally at mysticcaveman53@gmail.com. As always, thanks for listening. I'm Brian Pearson. This has been The Mystic Cave. But it's too late.